Welcome to episode 45, Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. Oh, and together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast.
Okay, we're recording on April 27th, 2017. Our week has been a little chaotic.
Yep.
And so I did not do a blog entry post. Did you do a blog entry post?
So you remember I had what I was calling a picture essay?
Yes.
With
all
of our
equipment?
I noticed
it. Yes.
So that's not up yet. Mm-hmm. It's not on the website, but it's partially written.
Right.
And I did get our last podcast up just like an hour ago.
Oh, that's awesome.
So.
Okay. Yeah. So tonight it should be a pretty short podcast. However, we have a lot of things that we'll be talking about, a lot of things that's coming up that we'll be doing. Do you want to start with the articles first?
Sure.
Okay. So Patrick found this cool article called Lord of the Rings, a giant laser sensitive to the spin of the planet.
Oh, I don't have that one up.
And the twist of earthquakes.
I totally forgot about that.
Did you?
Yeah.
So this article was written, was posted in Science April 20th, and it was written by Eric Han. And
that was really cool.
It was. And I'm really interested to see some of the stuff that comes out of it. So it's one of the largest and most sensitive lasers that we have.
Trying to get it. No, go ahead.
Okay. And
I can't believe I don't have it. It's on the other computer.
What's... Oh, here. I can...
No. I've got it. I can get it fast.
And so what's unique and different about it is that this is one of the largest, and it will be able to even detect things on Mars. That just kind of blew my mind. Mars
no,
and the moon.
No.
Did I mistake?
Yeah, okay. I'm trying to get it. So it's the whole concept. It's just for the Earth.
Okay.
Right? But what they're saying is the concept, I didn't even review this, but the concept is that, I can't remember what years, technology made these types of detectors possible, and they're mostly for detecting seismic events, mm-hmm. right? And the bigger you build them,
right,
the more different kinds of events you can record.
Right.
But there's some companies, and there's one in particular, I wish I could grab.
So 1970s is when they first started.
Yeah, but I don't think the technology made it possible until much later.
Okay, so the 1990s, they started to look at different things to create perfect mirrors. And in New Zealand, they made one out of World War II bunkers.
In World War II bunkers?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but the idea is there's some companies that are using the same technology now that we can do it to make tiny little ones.
Okay.
So their use is totally different.
Okay.
And so big ones you could measure certain types of events that you need extremely high sensitivity for, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But there's other events where you can deploy small sensors. They won't have the sensitivity of the big ones, right? But the current seismic sensors, the ones that are not the ring mm-hmm. type, ring laser or mm-hmm. ring light type, they're missing one of the axes. And the ring ones are way more expensive. But if you deploy one, because you've got one extra dimension, mm-hmm. I think, you need very few of them. Well, the other ones, you might need 100.
Got it.
So it might be way more expensive to put one up, but if you just put one, it's the same as putting out 100. So these tiny little ones are meant to do the same type of thing as this new big one, Romy, but in places where you might normally deploy many small ones, like on volcanoes.
Mm-hmm.
So Romy is out, where is it? Is it in Munich somewhere?
Yeah. So close to Munich? It's right at the beginning of the article because I remember. Yes, it's 20 kilometers from Munich, Germany.
Right. So it can't move.
Right.
I mean, it's just there.
Mm-hmm.
But, I'd totally forgotten about this cool article. I think I sent it to Isaac, too.
Yeah.
So, but other, so on some volcanoes you might want to put some, right?
Right, right.
So you put the small ones. And the Mars thing you were talking about is the
it's
same thing. You can't
small
put
ones.
A big one.
Yeah.
But you can use the technology, and you can't, you're not going to take 100 of them to Mars.
No.
Like we do on Earth, we do put hundreds around volcanoes, but they're not the ring type, right?
Right, so, right.
So you could put just one of these, take it to Mars, put it down, a small one. You're not going to get the information like the big one in Munich, this new one. But you can get information as if you had put out 100 of
them.
Got it. That's the concept behind the Mars one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Neat.
And I think they work, I'm trying to remember, this was quite a few days ago for me, but I think they work on interferometry. So mm-hmm. they shine light around a ring in two different directions, you know, in
right.
opposite directions. And one way around, it takes longer for the light to go through than the other, depending on waves going through the system.
Mm-hmm.
And they look at interference patterns to see what that was.
Neat.
I think that's the idea.
Neat.
Yeah.
Oh, it is just... I'm looking forward to seeing what comes out of this and seeing some of the information.
Yeah.
And they said it's going to take a while because there's a certain amount of, I assume, they have to run a number of experiments to,
For Rome?
Oh, yeah. For the experimental drift.
To understand what the drift is.
Yeah, well, so that's, I don't understand at all.
And
all the other ones that have been built
yeah.
have been built in places that seem like they make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And Romy, if you from this article, it seems like they chose a place that's in sediment instead of rock.
Oh.
And they've got all these settling issues. And it's like,
oh,
well, why?
I didn't understand the settling. And
yeah.
I knew they said that.
And not only that, but it's not just that it's sediment, but it's a particular kind that's particularly bad for...
Oh. Oh, darn.
Yeah, so
yeah,
I don't know what the deal is there.
Now I understand. Because they said there's a certain amount of experimental drift.
Yeah.
And, okay.
It
okay.
sounds like, you know, the adaptive optics for the Keck telescopes in Hawaii?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like the guy wants to do a similar type of thing for the mirrors that bounce the light around the rings.
Nice.
For Romy. Yeah, but it's like...
Yeah.
Really?
I know.
Anyway, I better check. I
very
touched.
Interesting, though. Just a cool technology, and
yeah.
it's
my mouse
neat
is,
to see.
What is happening here? I'm losing my mouse. I need
okay.
to check to see. I just touched the USB thing. No, we still have audio.
Okay.
Okay.
And then I was going to... Oh. And then I was, we have one other article that I looked at this week because it just came out April 25th. And it's from the special section on the ecosystem Earth. And it's called The Interaction of Human Population, Food Production, Biodiversity Protection. And it's by Eileen Chris, Camillo Mora, and Robert Engelman. And I was looking over that this evening, and, you know, as I was looking it over, they're looking at, you know, how our population and how people... worldwide are viewing it, and depending on our perceptions of,
you know, whether we have enough food production or if we can continue to produce enough, it impacts the amount of population growth. You know what I mean? Perception. And so they mentioned that in a few places. But
I think their main thing is historical.
Yes.
I don't know if they're saying how that it's really that having a huge impact on population growth directly.
But it stops, or...
They have a big push for family planning.
Right. But it inhibits family planning.
And right. Yeah. And they're saying, I mean, more than that, they're saying, I mean, it's not really obvious whether there would have been a huge impact globally if things had been different. But locally in different places, they have a lot of references to research showing that there's been an effect where you've had family planning. And but I mean, historically, they say in the 1970s there were all these dire predictions, and before that, even starting in the 1960s, about population growth growing out of control. And then you had the Green Revolution, and we didn't run out of food.
Right.
And so then people were like, okay, technology is going to solve everything. There is no carrying capacity of the earth.
Right.
Well, I mean, now we're into this, you know, it's weird. They keep making this point that scientists just aren't wanting to come forward and say, we got a population problem. On the other hand, they've come up with this concept of the Anthropocene, that time when we're destroying everything and we're leaving our footprint on the entire...
I especially like how the article addresses the rise of the middle class.
Yeah.
And how that middle class in India, the growth of that middle class in India and Africa will really impact production. Worldwide.
Well, consumption.
Consumption. That's what I meant. Humongous. Production because of consumption.
Right. Same thing.
And so it's just like, yeah, of course. But until you really think of it in terms of numbers, like the actual growth numbers of that population,
they have good graphs.
Is really incredible, where you have it rise from 3.2 to 3.2 billion to 5 billion worldwide, and 40% of it will be India, happening in India, it's predicted. And so it's just like, whoa, you know, that's a huge population that's and country that's going to be changed by it. Did I misquote that? Because you're looking at me strangely.
Well, I think that it's not 40% is happening in India. It's that 40% of India's population.
Yeah, pardon me. I misquoted. Yeah, of India's population. And it is really going to transform India.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's going to change the look of India. Yeah. And, you know.
On the one hand, it's going to change everything.
Yes. Yeah.
On the one hand, you know, you look at what it means. And you know what it means for the world, and it's so scary. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, as you read that, it's like there's this joy welling up.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, thank God these people are lifted out, you know, even though it's going to... I mean, I hate the whole concept that we're destroying the world. On the other hand, you know, to know that these people are going to be better off.
Yeah.
But I think that one of the... hugely important points about this art. So their big thing is we need to start talking about reducing population as a matter of policy and finding ways to
do
it. And I think they do it really in an appropriate way.
I think
there
they
is
do.
This issue with it being done with draconian measures in certain localities and
and
without respect.
I love their focus on, if you focus on educating
Women.
Women.
Human
rights.
Well, it's interesting. The human rights seems to be... It's not that you have to concentrate on human rights because if you don't, people won't follow it. it's more that human rights goes hand in hand with decreased population.
Exactly.
So it's like the two line up. So it's not even an issue whether you should do one or the other, right? And this was not an important part. I don't think it's this tiny little thing. Actually, it might have been one of the referred articles, might not have been in this one, where they say, you know, you don't ever need to tell a woman in an area that's resource poor and you're finally giving them family planning, you never have to tell a woman you should have so many children. What you need to tell her is you have whatever number you want, but you need to decide. And once you decide, you know, or you could, it's not you need to decide. It's more, it's like you can decide.
Right.
Right. It's up to you. That's a really cool way of putting it. But the really scary thing, so that was kind of like the nice thing. The really scary thing is this whole concept about what happened after the Green Revolution. And now people are like, well, how do we fix this? No problem. We just need to reduce waste, come up with new technologies for getting more food out and stuff. And they're saying, look at what's happened. That's what we said was great about the Green Revolution. And it came at the expense of absolutely destroying environment.
Right.
That's what that meant. Yes.
Water resources.
Technology really made huge differences and stuff, but it increased the ability to farm and it made it more lucrative. And actually, that's the interesting thing.
Also, it increased the amount of like dead zones and things that were happening along the coast. And it actually raised over 50%.
So I've got something to show you about that. But before we go on, they have really good graphs in this article. And I thought about the technology type stuff, figure one, there's four graphs, right? And the units are kind of funky, but so you see 1960 to 2010 and billions of people basically starts at 3 billion, goes up to 5 billion, and it's kind of like a straight line. Okay, fine.
Definitely.
And then you look at ecological footprint.
Yeah.
Basically the same thing.
Right.
It's going from some arbitrary unit, 0.4 to 1.2. And then you have response index, which is on a log scale, but the units aren't explained, so that doesn't mean anything. But it's kind of linear up also.
Right.
And supposedly that's a measure of all of the stuff that we've done to mitigate things. So more natural national parks, increased legislation to stop destruction or to protect species and stuff. And then they have this index. They called it the Living Planet Index. Unfortunately, still no explanation. But it basically blips up around, I don't know, 1970 and just plummets after that. And it's like, you can see that, right? It's like the people, number of people is going up. We try to do things to help nature and the planet's going to hell. And everybody knows it, right? And it's because the pressure we're putting on it, you know?
Right.
If you try to set up a national park and next to your city and your city doubles in size, the environment will go to hell.
Right.
Even with your nice little national park. It's just, there's no way around it.
Right. Exactly. But I...
So you want to see dead zones? I looked up one of the references, and the one on the dead zones was really cool. They have good maps. Here it is. So it's also out of science. It's a review from 2008. Let me see if I can find the volume. Volume 321. Page 926. It's one of the references in your article.
At the end.
And that was a fascinating article. But I'm just going to show you some picture of the world. This is from page 927. And basically, it's a picture of the world. And in dark green, you have areas where you have basically, It's that footprint index, I think, where humans have no effect. So Northwest Territories.
Right. Basically, the Siberia, northern part of Canada.
The Sahara, the central Australian deserts. And the Amazon, you can see that like that, except for you can basically trace the rivers, right?
Yes.
And all of the coastal areas are this bright red, huge human. All of Europe is red. All south of the Great Lakes in the U.S., southern Mexico, Central America, east coast of South America, equatorial Africa, India, China, Japan. Okay, and you look at these little white dots, which are hypoxic systems, basically dead zones, and they just line everywhere, especially in the north, more than the south, where actually India's pretty free. But it's not the same. It hasn't been recorded everywhere the same. That's what the issue is. But I mean, England, around Denmark, it's just horrible. The entire east coast of the United States, all around. And this is all eutrophication from farming, stuff going down, creating hypoxic areas. I came across an interesting term, Kattegat.
I'm not familiar with that.
It's, I don't want to say a word that's not right. I think it's the Kattegat. It's the sea just to the east of Denmark. It's like in between there, and the Baltic flows out through
that.
And so you have lots of stuff from Europe going out in there, and that is one of the just persistent dead zones. And
I always think of the Gulf of Mexico being a huge dead zone, and it's really not as orange as the area that you just pointed to.
Well, so that's the human footprint, right? Yeah. But it's the white dots that are the dead zones.
Oh, got
it. So it looks just as bad.
Yeah.
The Chesapeake Bay is supposed to be terrible. They have good explanations in this article describing the energy flows. And basically, and just how it happens.
Neat.
And yeah, the energy, the whole energy flow thing is interesting. But I thought the map was fantastic.
That is.
Anyway, you know, the article's, it's interesting. It's, you really have to look up the references to get like a lot of hard facts, it seems like, or the research. And even then you're looking up other reviews rather. So it was frustrating, but it's like hitting something that is really something big in my mind is that population, you know, philosophically, I don't even understand this, like this concept of, well, should we stabilize at 5 billion? And it's like, you know, it's lost for us. It's lost for our children and our grandchildren. But I'd like to think that people in the future could just go ahead and spend their life without worrying about stuff and drive around SUVs and whatnot, right? And why? I mean, we don't need a couple billion people on Earth in order to be, have the whole world still connected.
Right.
You know, I mean, it'd be, in my mind, it sounds crazy to most people, I think, but in my mind, if we were just several hundred million, that's huge still. You could have just a few humongous cities here and there, and then gigantic suburban zones surrounding them and stuff, and your footprint on Earth would be minuscule.
Right.
You know? Anyway, wishful, that's not even for us to discuss. I mean, we need, and there's an interesting thermodynamic concept here. Like they keep saying, reduce waste and and bring up new technologies to recycle and stuff. And I think we need to do that now.
Right.
But you know, there's this whole thing in thermodynamics where the more work you do, the more waste you have to create.
Right.
In terms of heat, right? And it's like, are we creating industries to do the recycling that also require a lot of work.
Right.
And we're actually making an important marginal effect on our footprint. Mm-hmm. You know, we shouldn't waste it. But in terms of long-term how we think of the human species, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Because you're working to try to mitigate all this other work, and you're mm-hmm. working even more to, you know.
Right.
When with fewer people, if that was not a concern, you could get on with trying to do other things.
Mm-hmm.
So, and progress. You know, the reason we've been able to do so much so fast in my mind is because of waste.
Mm-hmm.
Because of, you know, not that there hasn't been great industries coming out of dealing with waste and renewable energy and stuff, but it could be spent on that or on other things.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you're looking at the graph of estimated proportions. I totally didn't understand that.
Yeah.
It's the unintended pregnancies.
Yeah.
And it's the highest in North America.
Yeah.
The only way I read that is that it's it's highest in Latin America and Caribbean, but the only way I read developing nations having the highest rate of unintended pregnancy is that it's an education thing.
Right.
That's the only thing that makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. So. It'll be neat to see. More articles. Focused.
The whole.
Around this.
Yeah, the whole thing about empowering women.
Mm-hmm.
And education of girls, and that the research on that seems to be so strong
mm-hmm.
about that lifting people out of poverty and,
right,
and that being the way to reducing population also.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's just really cool. It's
it
like
is.
It lines up with human rights so well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw a strange statistic. I think it was in this one where they listed places where these types of implementations have been shown to have a strong effect on population.
Oh, yeah.
And not in the developed world, in
no.
developing countries.
Exactly. And
yeah.
the countries were really diverse.
Well,
you know, like they
so
weren't
they listed,
just from...
Yeah, so they listed, I think Korea, Bangladesh is one.
Yeah.
South Korea.
Bangladesh. I'm trying to think.
So
of
the one that really, I think there was a Central American country. Was it Costa Rica or something?
I'm trying to look for it.
But the one that really got me was they listed Iran.
Yes, I noticed that.
And I was like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Are they talking about during the time of the Shah?
Yeah.
Because I mean, how do you match increased? I guess maybe we don't. We have a different view of Iran. Yeah, it was extremely liberal society in the time of the Shah, even though
mm-hmm.
he was, you know. I mean, they went from one bad thing to another, but in terms of the population, it's weird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know where it was. So it was in this article.
Yes, it was. Because I remember reading it. I can't find it right now, but yeah. Okay. So so what have you been up to, Patrick?
Where do I start? Well, last time we had not done our last ARDF event yet,
no, we hadn't.
I guess we should talk about that.
Okay.
Had we done even one? Yeah, we had.
Yes. We had.
So we had a really low turnout. That was a bummer.
Right.
So
it was sort of like, oh.
Yeah. But I mean, we still had four people go out on the course.
We did. Not only that, we had a low turnout, and we had several emails telling us why they couldn't be there specifically.
That was really cool.
That was really nice.
That made me feel a lot better.
It did. And it just, you know, kind of kept Pat and I going that, yep. Yeah, this is good. Unfortunately, other things came up and,
yep.
And, you know, we totally understand that because we once had, you know, younger children.
Yep.
So,
we got a few of the big flags made, but we didn't get to use them.
Right.
Because we didn't have enough.
And we tried 2 meter for the first time.
Sort of. We deployed it.
And it was good that we deployed it then.
But no one had time to.
No one had time. Except for Patrick and I. And then we realized, one wasn't working. Yeah, and I think it was a battery issue.
I think it was
issue.
Just a battery.
Yeah. Which was something that was like, oh, that's too bad.
I need to check that.
But we'll check that and make sure that it's running for the next one. We do have quite a few things happening, though. In another week, we have another one. It will be our last
CCS
for the...
Maybe.
Spring. Yeah, maybe.
We're not sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's the last one
that's officially planned
right now.
Yep.
I don't know how we're going to prepare for it because we're going to visit Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to Augusta, Georgia this weekend.
Yep.
So that'll be a lot of fun.
It'll be great. And we're totally looking forward to it.
In a way, it'll be relaxing.
Yes.
Because in this absolute crazy time where there's no way we can get everything done, it'll pull us back from that and just...
Let us hang out for a day, which would be nice. So that'll be good.
So, but like you said, after that, we have one school event.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe our last one.
Right.
Of the spring. Maybe not.
Right.
And then the weekend after that, the very next weekend...
We have our very first BOK.
We have the first BOK one.
Mm-hmm. Which I have to say, yesterday morning caused a bit of a crazy time because we were thinking we had lots of time before anyone would even be thinking about ARTIF, and we had someone email and say, hey, where's the ARTIF notice?
Oh, right.
Can we register?
Right.
And we're like, what?
Oh, my gosh. I had already written the announcement. And that was what was crazy. The night before,
mm-hmm.
we'd gone over, okay, I wrote the announcement, and we need to make sure it's written correctly and everything, but we still have like a couple weeks, so we'll look at it. And also, we had some concerns that the way Joseph Huberman wants to set it up would put too much frequencies on the air. And so we talked about like all the things about our experience, and we wrote it all up to email him to let him know, you know, we'd really like to do it a different way.
Right.
And I'm like, so do we post first and then send email or what? And I'd written it so that he could go in and still do his thing if, you know, without changing the post too much. And then, like you said, the very next day we wake up, and that night someone had written us an email saying, hey, how do I register? We're like, post it.
I know.
And then I found out from that there was no way to register. It wasn't on the list. And Joseph was, I think he's off on a trip according to our notes.
Yeah, they're off sailing somewhere.
He was obviously checking his email because he emailed back.
Which was exciting.
So I sent him the stuff and he was really cool about it.
Which was nice. So as Pat and I are planning these events, we found that a lot of our conversations and work for trying to get this new sport introduced in an area that knows nothing about ARTIF is really communication and trying to figure out how best to communicate what we're doing with others so that they feel comfortable enough to come out and they realize that it's just about coming and try something new.
Yeah.
And
that's the toughest part.
You know, and when you have such a new sport in an area or introducing a new sport in an area like this, there's people are very hesitant about just coming out
Yeah.
Because they don't know what it entails.
Right.
And we have a few strong families that are with us. And I mean strong as in they've come out several times. They're like diehards. They've come out at least 3 times for 3 different events. And they understand.
Yeah,
and they understand so cool. Our purpose of being out there.
Yeah.
So it's like it's very comfortable when they come.
Yeah.
And they're slowly getting the word out. And so now we're getting a few other parents that are coming on, and they kind of look at us on it from a distance. They don't come too close because they don't know. And so it's, and even at school, the most frustrating thing is like, we're having an ARDF event planned this weekend. And so we'll go, oh yeah, it's geocaching, isn't it?
No,
it's not. It's different. Anyway, so I just wanted to share that's one of the challenges for us playing this out. So anytime we get feedback like, where's this? Or you know, did you think of this? We're like, oh no, we're behind. We wanted to show them we had it together. So, but anyway. Well,
one thing that's been really cool is... Charles and Nadia Charlot coming to every event so far, or almost, I think they've been to every event.
And they just
to help out.
Yes. And they've been so committed. In fact, last week I'm like, you know, you don't have to go and pick up every time. We really appreciate it. Please don't feel you have to. And they're like us. They're trying to get, ARDF in our area so that people know about it and people will come out and hopefully become more involved, and we'll set up a community here that will then be able to travel to other places and compete with other clubs. But it's one of those things that it's...
And he gave us a huge bag of tuners for the
antennas,
which... So, got to use one of them.
Yeah.
During the event on Fox number 4.
Right.
And then, it's going to take a bit of fixing them to get them to be easy to work with, because I ran out of time, basically. I took all, it's funny, I carried all of them over my entire course setting, after setting the first one, I just carried them with me extra weight because I just ran out of time.
So this is like 5 more pounds. Of extra stuff that you were carrying around with you.
Maybe more, maybe less, I'm not sure. But the thing is, we have the BOK ARDF meets coming up, and they're a little bit longer. And, you know, I really want to have the kids have good signals.
Right.
When they get there. So I got to find a way to make it easy. So you don't even know about this, but I've had this idea, and we've talked about it before a while ago, and I think I'm going to have to, at least for a while, start going out Friday evening after work and just setting the verticals up on some of the places so that I don't have to spend so much time the morning of the event.
Yeah.
And the reason I started to think that is if we're putting out both 80 and 2 meters on the same day, well, I'm going to run out of time.
Right.
As long as the 2 meters close, I'm really not going to run out of time as long as nothing goes wrong. But, you know, last time we had it incredibly close.
Mm-hmm.
Well, suddenly BOK events, I'm going to have to go a lot further that morning.
Right.
And, I think I'm going to have to set up some of the verticals the night before.
And maybe a bicycle.
Go by bicycle? But how do I carry...
Yeah, we're still thinking
about gotta figure this
these
out.
Options.
Yeah.
And it may be stashing different backpacks at different areas and gathering one, putting one down, going off.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Not sure.
Yep. We'll figure it out.
But I could try out just a little bit at the next event.
Mm-hmm.
Just set up like a couple antennas Fridays.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And so, I don't know.
Nope.
We'll see. Oh, and we got to use... Well, no, we didn't. We deployed the course timing system.
Right.
For the first... And again, we only did it for 2 meter and everybody had to leave, so...
Everybody everybody had to run someplace. Yeah. So no one got to try the 2 meter and our new timing system.
No.
However, Charles thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So we're looking forward to trying out our new timing system May 6th, maybe. Just with 2 transmitters with the 2 meters.
Yeah, hopefully more than that.
Hopefully more, but we will see. And our big meet coming up with the following week on the 13th.
And we didn't even mention one reason it's been so crazy is the last ARDF for school, so that was April 22nd. April 23rd, we had an O-meet.
Oh, that's true.
Mm-hmm. So we were in
we were outside the whole weekend.
So we were out there the entire day.
Mm-hmm.
We helped with registration and stuff, and then we helped with pickup. That was so cool. We'd helped for a while, and Dave Waller, who was the director, said first to me, you know, you can go ahead if you want, and then later to you. And I was in the middle of my course, in the middle of CNF.
Yeah.
And
we're out orienteering on a course. We're 2 different courses. Yeah. I'm on a brown, Pat's on a blue.
No, he had red.
Red, okay.
Yeah. And suddenly I hear Patrick from the distance. And we're really in the very center of the forest.
Yeah. And you're coming out of the woods. And there's some kind of small path going off. And then I come out and it's a little bit of a clearing, which is kind of unusual in the areas that you're running through. And to be able to see as far as 20 meters.
So that was fun.
Yep.
So we did pick up. But then we got home and all the stuff was just soaking wet. It had been raining all day. And we set everything out to dry and stuff. Mm-hmm. And there was just practically no time to get equipment ready for our next ARDF meet. So.
Right. Yeah, because it was one wet weekend.
Yeah. And we don't have one coming up soon, but isn't there an O-meet right after our...
Oh, yeah. The next day.
How does that work?
The next day, and we have to hand off things to...
Lena.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. So it's going to be very busy, and I think it'll be a lot of fun, though. And I think we just
need to survive until June 3rd.
Yep.
That's our last BOK event, and the weekend after that is high school graduation.
Right.
It's unlikely that anything will happen after that.
Yeah. So exciting. And fun times.
Yeah.
So, do you have any other news?
I'm trying to think. I'm sure there's stuff I'm forgetting.
Okay.
But I can't think of it. So, should we wrap up?
Okay, we'll wrap up.
Okay, well, thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out the blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.